This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, and, I'm just sitting here reading social media stuff. Let's be honest. How many of you honestly believe, that Donald Trump is a plant? That it's some sort of a revenge campaign against the GOP, that it's all set up. Do you believe? I mean, I suppose some of you do believe it because I get notes from some of you every day on such things. So I thought I would just ask, I mean, do you really believe that? I believe that he is a product of a failed administration, an anger that's bubbling to the surface, and it's evidenced not only by Donald Trump, but by Bernie Sanders as well. Discontent with this president comes from both the left and the right. It's not unique to one side or the other. Moderates also. Those down the middle are up, you know, don't like where we stand in a variety of areas. Security, economy. List goes on. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this yesterday. You probably heard this, but Megyn Kelly will be sitting down with Donald Trump finally. I've predicted this for a long time. Think about the ratings. Boom. Strangely enough, it's happening in May, in the middle of sweeps. Isn't that something? The May sweeps. Right in the middle of the month, Megyn Kelly will be sitting down with him. And I believe it's a different show. It's like, I heard him talking about it on the air. It doesn't matter. It'd be May 17th. They met privately at Trump Tower in New York earlier this month at a face-to-face. The network said Kelly had requested and Fox News Chairman Roger Ailes brokered. Ailes has spoken to Trump a few times in the last few months, so there you have it. That's coming up soon. Okay, in the next hour here on the program, Randy Barnett will be here, Georgetown law professor. For those of you that want a third-party candidacy, now is your time. That's what he says. Now is the time. We'll talk to him, Georgetown law professor, coming up here shortly. Plus, Patrick Michaels will be here. And this is one you don't want to miss. Director for the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute, talking about climate science. We have a brand new study out. It's a huge study. 32 scientists, 24 colleges and universities, 8 different countries, saying CO2, you know, the notorious CO2, making the planet greener and cleaner. Every day. Yeah, go figure. Secretary of State John Kerry and his wife Teresa Hines, that is, have invested millions upon millions of U.S. dollars in at least 11 offshore tax havens. This, according to the Daily Caller and an investigative group there. The revelation comes on the heels of the release of the Panama Papers. You heard about these not too long ago. A treasure trove of 11.5 million legal and financial records documenting how some of the world's richest and most powerful people have used offshore bank accounts to conceal their wealth and avoid taxes. Well, guess what? Guess what? Here is former Massachusetts Democratic senator and his billionaire wife using an elaborate set of Hines family trusts. They've invested well more than $1 million each into at least 11 separate offshore accounts, mainly hedge funds in the Cayman Islands. The investments, again, this is according to the Daily Caller, the investments were made during both Kerry's tenure in the Senate and in his present position as the nation's chief diplomat. The trust funneled millions of dollars over the years into various offshore investment vehicles through a Hines trust called the Hines Family Commingled Alternative Investment Fund. Two other trusts appear to have been set up by the Hines family since Kerry was appointed by President Barack Obama in 2013 to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. One called HFI Intermediate Fund 2 and the other HFI Dividend Investments, and it goes on and on. According to Susan Harley, Deputy Director of Congress Watch, a progressive lobby organization founded by Ralph Nader, well, I'd say it doesn't look good by any means. It doesn't look good by any means, she says. There's always a question whether it's tax avoidance or tax evasion. We would expect our government servants to uphold the law. Those folks need to be held to the same standards as everyone else. So, John Kerry, tax cheat? It's kind of the implication there. Britain's single-payer healthcare system descended into chaos yesterday as thousands of the country's junior doctors went on strike over a pay dispute. I'm helping you look into the crystal ball now into the future here at home. Junior doctors, basically the equivalent of residents here in the U.S., have had intermittent work stoppages over the last few months. But until now, they kept working in critical areas such as emergency, maternity, and intensive care. Now, those doctors are walking off the job, which leaves the U.K. and its citizens well in a pinch. 78% of those doctors didn't show up to work yesterday. They just said, you know what, we're not coming in. That according to the Guardian newspaper. The walkout only covering daytime hours, so the striking doctors will leave from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and then return for the overnight shift before hitting the bricks again. So, socialized medicine. Obamacare. How's that working out? Oh, speaking of Obamacare, Americans can expect the cost of their health insurance premiums to expand under Obamacare due to the hefty losses the law has caused for so many insurers across the nation. The Hill reporting, insurers are ready for the increases to make up for the financial strain they have faced since the president's landmark health care legislation was implemented in a backroom deal. Sabrina Corlett, a professor at Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reforms, says there are absolutely some carriers that are going to have to come in with some pretty significant price hikes to make up for the underpricing that they have been through before. According to a study released by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, insurers were hit with losses that exceed $2.2 billion in 2014 alone, despite receiving $6.7 billion in net reinsurance payments. Isn't it something how deeply into your pocket they can go to make their laws work? So in the UK, you've got a medical crisis because the young doctors are saying, we're getting the shaft here. In America, the same sort of thing is going on. And the signs in the streets of the UK, keep your hands off our pay. Keep your hands off from our pay. See, it's a pay battle. And those same battles are going to come right here to America. The same problems are going to you're going to have the same pinch point. Because when you're not getting enough out of the system and you're insuring people that can't pay for it and the taxpayers are picking up the bill, you have to trim and cut somewhere and the doctors are going to be the ones getting pinched. And what you're seeing in the UK right now, you will see in America because of Obamacare. The only question is when. The only question is when. But premiums are on the rise, that's for sure. Straight ahead, we'll talk about a third-party candidacy with another Georgetown law professor, Randy Barnett. It's Wednesday on the Steve Gruber Show.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
All right, welcome back to it. It's Wednesday here on the Steve Gruber Show. Glad to have you on board. And Donald Trump sweeps through five more states. Mathematically speaking, he is going to make it, I believe. I mean, he's going to win in New Jersey. He'll win in California. That's 223 winner-take-all states. Plus, he'll take winner-take-most in Indiana, where he's ahead by, oh, I don't know, 8 points. He'll take some in West Virginia. He'll take some in South Dakota. He should arrive in July, I believe, with enough to secure the nomination. And for some, that is a frightening proposition. I was watching last night some of the hardcore conservatives. I mean, the bitterness, the discontent of the Republican folks appearing on television was obvious. And they are concerned, so concerned that some say it's time for a third party. One of those, Randy Barnett, Georgetown Law Professor. Professor, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Steve.
Now, you wrote a piece for USA Today here. Said it's time for a third party if Donald Trump gets the Republican nomination. Well, we're right on the cusp, Professor. But third party nominations are most oftentimes an abject failure. So what do you suggest?
Well, actually, when I wrote that piece, it might have been time for that, or might have been able to do that. But since then, the time for third parties qualifying for ballot access has passed. However, the time for an independent candidate to run, not as a third party, but simply as an independent, like Ross Perot did, that's still quite feasible. There are really only two states that have early registration or early ballot access for that, and both of those states could actually be challenged. So a third party is an independent run is still possible, and one of the values of doing it would be to give down-ticket Republicans a presidential candidate, a conservative presidential candidate they could support in the general election and help save the Republican Congress.
A large number of those voting for Donald Trump, according to the exit polling over the last couple of weeks I've been watching very closely, identify themselves as very conservative, much to the chagrin of those others like yourself that identify themselves as very conservative. You've got a problem because very conservative people are voting for Donald Trump. If you put out a third-party candidate, if a third-party candidate is put into the race, you're being complicit in the election of Hillary Clinton.
Well, people are going to have to make their judgment as to whether it's better, as Hamilton said about Jefferson, to have somebody in the White House who you oppose of the other party or somebody in the White House who you are partially responsible for. Donald Trump will remake the Republican Party if he's the nominee. All presidents remake the party in their image, and that actually might be worse for the future of the country than having Hillary in office.
I strongly disagree with that. You also have a premise here, Professor, that you believe the GOP establishment created Donald Trump. In part, that's true. I agree with that because the Americans have gone to the polls at different times, and they voted on concerns like the border and been ignored, the debt and been ignored, jobs in the economy and been ignored, the EPA, we've been ignored, making sure the military is taken care of, and the VA, and we've all been ignored. But not just by the Republicans. I believe, honestly, as I look at the landscape this year, that Barack Obama created not only Donald Trump, but Bernie Sanders as well. I always believe that Jimmy Carter created the opportunity for Ronald Reagan to become president. And I believe that Barack Obama has created this atmosphere in American politics today that gave us both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Am I wrong about that?
No, I agree with all that. I agree that George Bush gave us Obama as well. I think you're right. And I think this, I mean, what you, I thank you for picking, since we don't agree about some of this stuff, I thank you for identifying that line of my piece, because I understand the substantive appeal of Donald Trump. That's not the problem. Not really. I'm not objecting to most of what his supporters want to see done. What I'm objecting to is him as the person to do it. There's no absolutely no reason to trust this real estate developer hustler to actually do anything that he says he's going to do once he has the nomination secured and once if he's ever president, which I sincerely doubt he ever will be.
Well, a lot of people said he had no chance in June, July, August. You understand the whole thing. We've been told all this time that he couldn't win. He can win. And here's my other my point that I would make. We shouldn't trust this hustler, as you termed it. And yet we've got a person on the other side as the presumptive nominee for the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, whose trustworthy numbers are like 15%. Her problem is that nobody trusts her.
So, they don't trust her to be the lefty she now says she is, and that would actually be better for us if she's not.
No, they don't trust her, period. They don't trust her because of the emails. They don't trust her because of Benghazi. They don't trust her, period. The American people.
You're not going to get a slightest bit of defense of Hillary Clinton from me.
No, I understand.
Nor will you from any of the conservative or libertarians who are pretty appalled that a demagogue like Donald Trump, and who's really, we believe, a phony, could actually take the Republican nomination.
Well, here's
the
thing.
He's going to be the third liberal Northeastern Democrat, the Republican, liberal, the Republicans are going to put it as their candidate in a row.
So, Professor, here's my last little question before we have to run. But, you know, everybody knew that Bob Dole was a rhino and couldn't win. And everybody knew that, you know, John McCain was a bit of a rhino and probably couldn't win. But people weren't panicking, saying, oh, my God, he's going to lose in November. We need to do something different. I think the concern the whole time, Professor, is that not that Donald Trump would lose, but quite the contrary, that he would, in fact, win. And I'll give you 20 seconds for the last word.
I think I share that view. I would be concerned that he'd win, and because of what he would do to the Republican Party and what he would do to the conservative movement in this country.
So the concern then remains. Okay, so I guess we should have you back to figure out what the next move is then, because after Indiana, Katie barred the door, the party's over. But, Professor, good conversation. And I appreciate you coming in. And I'd like to talk to you again in the future about where we go next if the concern is Donald Trump.
That's great. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Professor Randy Barnett, Georgetown Law Professor. Look him up online. So much to read, so much to know, so much to do on The Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. American values with Midwestern common sense.
All right, welcome to it. It is Wednesday, making our turn around the bottom of the hour here. And so I was reading an interesting article. This, a lot of articles out there, this particular one written by Andrew Follett, says rising carbon dioxide levels are causing an explosion in plant growth, according to a huge scientific study published Monday in the journal Nature Climate Change. Who knew there was such a journal? I don't know where these journals come from. The study, the largest of its kind, written by 32 scientists from 24 colleges and universities in 8 countries. It used 3 long-term satellite records of plant area and 10 different global ecosystem models to measure increasing plant growth. The study estimates roughly half of the Earth's landmass showed significant greening, and only 4% of the world saw a decrease in plant life. The study noted vegetation growth is likely slowing global warming as well, since more trees and plants equates to more sequestered CO2. The conclusion here, it seems to be, CO2 is literally making the Earth a greener, cleaner, more wonderful place. I guess I'll have to ask my next guest. Patrick Michaels is the director at the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute, climate science. And they want to arrest those that question so-called science. I wonder if all these professors and so forth are going to be arrested. Patrick Michaels, welcome back.
Hey, how are you, Steve?
I'm good. Have you seen the study that I just cited?
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. So, okay, are they going to run out and arrest all these folks, throw them in jail, throw them in the gulag for, you know, thought crimes?
Well, they might. I mean, you know, there's nothing in climate change that isn't punished more than telling the truth. But it's a study that's been around actually for 20 years or so. We've had satellites up there that see the planet getting greener. And the reason is because we're putting more carbon dioxide in the air, which, one, makes plants grow better, and two, makes the growing season, the time between the first or last frost in the spring and the first one in the fall, a bit longer. So you see it, by and large, the planet getting greener. By the way, the greening up tends to take place in the margins of the world's great deserts. So the land that you really didn't want to live in has become much more habitable. Aside from that, this is a terrible, terrible problem.
I'm going to give you the last two little paragraphs from this story I was citing. The research is an enormous boost for scientists skeptical of global warming, as it indicates they were correct about a long-running positive effect of rising CO2. Carbon dioxide fertilizes plants, and emissions from fossil fuels have already had a hugely beneficial effect on crops, increasing yields by 10 to 15%, concludes a report published last October by the UK-based Global Warming Policy Foundation, an organization primarily focused on countering policy endeavors of global warming activists. That report estimates, now listen to this, that report estimates the global CO2 fertilization effect on the world's crops is worth $140 billion a year. Global warming, it's not just good for the planet, it's good business, apparently. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I'm not shocked. You know, when I was in graduate school, which was back in the Ice Age, it was well known that if you put carbon dioxide in the air, plants grow better. Remember in high school, I don't remember high school, but the old equation of photosynthesis, which is CO2, carbon dioxide, plus H2O, water, yields CH2O, carbohydrate. So if you increase the concentration of either of the reactants, water, meaning you water your plants, or CO2, meaning you put more CO2 in the air, you get more CH2O. Shocking! High school science, well known to people back then who had a high school education. Unfortunately, people right now don't have that.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, man. I think that, well, when you have a world today, Patrick, when you have a world today where people get their science from people like, what's his name, Bill Nye, the science guy?
Bill Nye,
Who knows nothing about science, nothing. He doesn't know much about anything, to be honest with you. We're in a world today where kids stare at their smartphones, and, you know, and Al Gore gives them science lessons, and Michael Moore gives them science lessons, and all of these other frauds give them science. It's no wonder that, you know, people believe, oh, my God. Because here's what I ask people. I don't know what you do, but here's what I've been taking to asking people. All right, if it's so bad, can you give me one example? Not something you've seen on TV, not something you read on the internet. Give me one personal observation of something that global warming has done to make the planet worse off in your personal experience. And they just stare at you because they have nothing to offer. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
That's exactly right, Steve. If we were not constantly bombarded with all this so-called information, nobody would notice, literally, that the planet is warmer by 1 degree than it was 100 years ago. Because you would not see anything that was detectable to your eye.
Well, actually, my personal experience, I would say this. In my personal experience, not this winter, but the previous two, the winter, three winters back, two winters ago, if you will, was the third coldest in this part of the country ever recorded. Last winter was pretty brutal. This most recent winter that we're just coming out of, a little bit milder. But we had, in the last 3 years, two of the most brutal winters, in my recollection, in the upper Midwest ever. I mean, in my lifetime, just brutal cold, deep cold, you know, and it was a lot of snow. And it's like, okay, can somebody, because I just saw a statement online somewhere. I wish I had pulled the article up, but I didn't save it, Patrick. Oh, 2016, the first 3 months of the year, the hottest ever recorded. And I'm thinking, like, that is such BS. It's the same thing every, oh my God, 2016, the February, January, February, March, the hottest ever recorded. Where? Because we've had a cold, snow-filled spring, and I've been watching this country, and, you know, I watch North America mostly. Where is it the hottest? It's the whole world. Oh, bull. I mean, are people not smart enough to say, you know, that's not really true? It's not that hot. Last year in Michigan, we had exactly one day that I saw that broke 90 degrees. One. You know, when I grew up, it was 95 degrees and 95 humidity for half of July every year. I don't see it anymore. What's going on, Patrick?
Well, you know, we're in the fading stages of something called an El Nino, which is a natural and periodic warming of the tropical Pacific Ocean. And when that happens, global temperature spikes. And when it goes away, all the cold water that was underneath the surface that El Nino suppressed bubbles upward and global temperature drops. And it is dropping now. It is dropping like a rock.
All right, hold that thought right there. Hold that thought right there, because we want to talk more about that with Patrick Michaels from the Cato Institute, Center for the Study of Science. Straight ahead this Wednesday on the Steve Gruber Show. Sit tight.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
After on this Wednesday, always a fascinating conversation with Patrick Michaels. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute. And so here's the, you know, we talk about this study that shows that CO2 is not only not harmful to the planet, it seems to be very beneficial to the planet, the greening of the planet, if you will, with the vast majority of the planet becoming more inhabitable, and because it arrests CO2 and puts it into play in the plant, it takes it out of circulation so that it, you know, those that believe in global warming or climate change or whatever should be thrilled by the fact that there's a greening of the world, and yet they're not, of course. Here in Michigan, the drive continues to eliminate all coal-fired power plants. That drive continues elsewhere. There's a move to put an initiative on the ballot this fall that would make fracking illegal, because obviously sitting in the dark is a big help if you don't have power. I mean, that's a big help to any civilized society. What I don't understand, Patrick, is that no matter what the overwhelming proof becomes that the Earth is greening from satellite studies, that we're up 1 degree in the last 100 years, as you pointed out, that we are producing more food today than at any time in the history of man. I mean, if you go back to 1970 and the dire predictions of the so-called environmentalists and earth scientists, pretty much everything they said was flat out wrong. We're not starving. We're not out of fossil fuels. People are not, you know, dying because of a nuclear type winter because of dust in the atmosphere or anything else. And yet these people continue to get government dollars and government grants to go do more studies, even though every study they've ever done has been a complete and abject failure. Am I missing anything so far?
No, you're not. The climate alarmists seem to function best in a data-free environment. And this new study by Mainini and all his guys at Boston is another thing that just is totally embarrassing, but actually is science that's been known for 30 or 40 years, that if you put carbon dioxide in the air, you make the planet greener, and more than anything else, you warm up the coldest temperatures of the winter. What's not to like, Steve?
Well, exactly. I mean, I like winter well enough, I do.
I do too.
I will tell you, by that last big snowstorm about the 10th of April, I had all I could take, which we did, you know, earlier, I was all done at that point. Thankfully, it's moderated greatly since, because trust me, it wears a person out. There's no question about it. So, okay, what do we do then?
It does.
What do we do then to change, and God help me for using this term, what do we do to change hearts and minds? God forgive me for using that trite term, but what do we do to get their attention? Say, listen, guys, Chicken Little was wrong. It was an acorn that fell, not the sky. This whole henny-penny attitude is just killing me. What do we do to get people to turn around and say, listen, look at what the truth is?
How about we tell the story of history? I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but by my count, I have lived through 9 environmental ends of the world. And in each and every one of them, the proponents of gloom and doom were as serious as they are now about climate change. Well, obviously, none of them happened. Now, when you have this repeating phenomenon of people talking of the end of the world from whatever cause, and it never happening, my advice is that we should all go short on apocalypse futures. What do you think? By the way,
wow,
if you're wrong,
I just snorted on
you
the
won't
air.
Be around to pay up.
Yeah. Yeah, we won't be here. I mean, I think it's more likely that the super volcano in Yellowstone will take us out before that happens. And you know, that's more likely and actually based in science. Crazy, isn't it?
It is, but I wouldn't hold my breath for that one either.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about that one either. But I'm just saying, you know, that's the fact of the matter is you have ocean currents.
It will happen someday, and we will get hit by an asteroid someday, but probably not someday soon, probably someday much later. And, you know, what do you want to do about that?
But you have this groupthink out there.
There's nothing you can do about it.
I mean, here's one of the things we talk about. We're on the line with Patrick Michaels from the Cato Institute, the director of the Center for the Study of Science. We have this groupthink mentality out there. All of these little, you know, fascist liberal militants, you know, saying, well, the earth's going to ruin and you have to stop fracking because, you know, your tap water will explode and we're all going to die and Michael Moore might eat us all. Well, wait a second. Maybe that wasn't part of it. But you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying. And the resistance to hydrofracking of shale, frankly, is juvenile. Even Obama's EPA says it does not cause problems. And what it does, of course, is it produces abundant energy. We are now literally the Saudi Arabia of oil and natural gas. We have never produced so much in our history as a nation. And I'd like to take you back to 20 years ago where you and I were told we're running out of natural gas, we're running out of oil, please start, gentlemen, start your windmills. Well, that's not what happened, is it? You see, because we can't predict the future. We don't know what the energy structure of our society is going to be 100 years from now. And yet we try and change it with windmills and solar power and other things that will not and will never, ever, ever provide general, dependable energy. We try to do that.
Oh, you're such a pessimist.
This green monster.
You're just such a pessimist, Patrick. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I know. Always a great conversation because it's enlightening and straightforward, and it's a bit sarcastic, which I greatly appreciate. Patrick, we'll talk soon.
Bye, Steve.
Patrick Michaels, director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute, and always a pleasure. Back in a moment.